Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ian Hurst was what we sometimes call a spook.
Our job was to recruit, direct, control, and exploit human intelligence.
During the Troubles, he worked for a British Army covert military intelligence group, the Force Research Unit, or the FRU.
Within the FRU office is both a Joint Intelligence Research Officer, plus we also have a MI5 agent who sits directly opposite the Ops Officer.
After retiring, he co-authored a book under the pseudonym Martin Ingram.
The state, they'd taken an ex-party injunction out against me and threatened to prosecute me under the Official Secrets Act.
In it, he exposed Freddy Scapaticci as the Army agent, steak knife.
When the book was being developed, Mr. Scapaticci issued a number of affidavits, specifically requesting that the state prosecute me for a breach of confidence.
Some question aspects of Mr. Hurst's account, the extent of his role and his motivations. But in this episode of The Bell Tell, he gives his version of events.
The argument which was being put forward in political circles was that the unit was rogue, and there was nothing further from the truth.
Why he maintains former IRA leader Martin McGuinness was compromised.
I am absolutely 100% convinced that Mr. McGuinness was an agent of influence.
And why he exposed Freddy Scapaticci.
So I made it very clear to Mr. Scapaticci that I would indeed fall on my sword, but that would only be so if he was not the agent state knife.
Ian Hurst, many people will know you as the man who outed Freddy Scapaticci as steak knife. But for the benefit of our other listeners, who are you?
Okay, so I was a former handler within the FRU. For absolute clarity, I never met Mr. Scapaticci, but I was aware of his presence and I was aware of his role. And ultimately, throughout my FRU career, Mr. Scapaticci was one of the key agents, which was run by the FRU, which obviously we saw his I saw his product. I never once saw any contact forms. They're the document which is organic and to each agent, and they record everything about the debrief, including the audio recordings of those meetings. So essentially, I was in an office prior to me joining the FRU when I was in 12 Intelligence Company, and we used to handle out of hours the telephone calls, both for Box, for Five, but also for the rabbit, the Rattle, which was down below us. And one evening I was doing some late night work and we got a call through. And essentially, it was Mr. Scapaticci making or requesting his phone call in regards to his situation, which had developed with a drink drug charge. And the police officer made it clear who it was that was seeking to make this call. And clearly, it had come through on a telephone number, which we knew who it related to. And that was the start of knowing who that agent was.
Can I ask, just for the benefit of the listeners, because people may not be as aware of these things as we are, but what was the FRU?
The FRU is an agent handling, so covert human sources, human intelligence. So our job was to recruit, direct, control, and exploit human intelligence.
Ian, you mentioned Scapatici straight away. Now, I mean, anyone who listens to this podcast, and almost everyone in here, will know who Freddie Scapatici was. He's now dead. He was a very senior member of the IRA's internal security squad, known in the vernacular as the Nutting Squad, and he turned out to be an agent. You exposed Scapatici. Can I ask why?
So essentially, the process started in late 1999 when I took exception to a piece that John Ware wrote in the Telegraph, and it dealt with, disparagingly, the FRU as a rogue unit, and it was dealing ostensibly with loyalism, because clearly we run agents within loyalism as well as within the Republican movement. And the argument being that the unit was rogue, and there was nothing further from the truth, and I believed that I could prove that that wasn't the case. And eventually we did prove that, because Liam Clark, God rest his souls, did quite a few pieces right at the start. Mr. Scapatici never factored in those early exchanges. It was to do with identifying other interesting matters. The first being was Mr. Adams. But when we look at actually the reason why, and how we demolished the rogue unit argument, was that I spoke to Sue Ward, and we had multiple meetings where I explained to him that a classified document, when it's originated, is accompanied by a Mod Form 24, which is a classified receipt. And their eyes lit up when they realized when I explained to them each document has a distribution list. And let's, for argument's sake, it has 20 people on that distribution list. They go to all different agencies. But every one of those documents is a classified document, secret document, and it's accompanied by an individual receipt. So when it goes to the head of special branch, his clerk has to sign for that document. And that receipt is then returned to the originating unit, and it is entered into what's called a Mod Form 102. It's for anoraks, but it's a really important way of ensuring that classified documents are secure, and essentially if there is a compromise, where that compromise has taken place. But the police absolutely had no idea about this. And I think you'll find in the Sunday Times in the early 2000s, there was three photographs of crates which were recovered with the Mod Form 24s, which allowed Stevens 3 to identify that the police had been in receipt of the intelligence which they denied having access to. And at this stage, I must remind both you and your listeners that the police have primacy. We essentially work for the head of special branch. Every document which is produced, including the contact forms, is distributed to the head of special branch. Within the FRU office is both a joint intelligence research officer, plus we also have a MI5 agent who sits directly opposite the ops officer. So they're in complete knowledge of each and every document which is generated throughout the offices of the FRU, which are throughout the six counties.
Ian, you co-authored a book and give a lot of details about intelligence operations. I mean, for me, I would have assumed that all of these things have to be kept secret. But was it to defend the honour of your unit? Is that
No. That was the genesis to it, in regards to defending the FRU. And I'm on record, Kieran, as saying that I would defend and continue to defend 99.9% of all FRU operations. There are one or two notable exemptions, which I did in service, and I've done out of service. Brian Nelson is one case that I took issue with in service. And Scappaticci is another case which, although I didn't actually raise in service because of a close association with one of the primary handlers, I was well aware of some of the nefarious activities that he engaged in. Now, the book, when you are working and operating in this environment, you're living off a different oxygen than you live off when you leave service. So on reflection, I believed, and the state, in fairness, at this stage, they'd taken an ex-party injunction out against me and threatened to prosecute me under the Official Secrets Act. So when the book was being developed, Mr. Scappaticci issued a number of affidavits, specifically requesting that the state prosecute me for a breach of confidence. So I made it very clear to Mr. Scappaticci that I would indeed accept that I would owe him a duty of confidentiality. But that would only be so if he was not the agent state knife. So in return for me falling on my sword, I expected him to admit to his role. And he declined that offer.
I think we can all say now, without any reasonable doubt, that Freddie Scappaticci was, in fact, of course, steak knife. And the interim Operation Canova report didn't state that directly, but almost did, I suppose we can put it that way. What's your response to that initial Operation Canova report?
On behalf of the state, he's done a really good handling job. And he has managed to spend £40 million. And he has not once examined the real key elements. And I give you one example. So what was the legal basis of conspiring for handlers to recruit an agent in the first instance and ask them to join a prescribed organization? So the first thing that I, as an investigator, would do is lay out the legal basis. He doesn't touch on any of the minutiae. He prefers to do essentially an overview. So in essence, I'm not surprised. Unfortunately, Mr. Boucher and myself have engaged in correspondence since mid-2016. And initially, my concern was raised because he spent the first 6 months getting his arms around the shoulders of the alleged victims. Well, essentially, as I explained to him, they're not victims, alleged victims, until such time as you've substantiated there's been an offence committed.
Canova has criticised the intelligence services, saying they exaggerated Scappaticci's usefulness, saying not hundreds of lives were saved, simply single figures.
Well, I can think of three cases that Mrs. Scappaticci saved the lives of. One being the first compromise of Frank Hegarty, the second being these are cases that I was involved in. And the second one being the extraction of Willie Carlin, the third one being a source in South Armagh. Now, so those three lives. But what he fails to actually understand and articulate is that the Republican movement, they knew that they were penetrated at a very senior level. And that literally, that destabilized that movement. And God knows how many others were saved because of the level of penetration, not just of Mr. Scappaticci, but of others as well. So for him to just, you know, take an arbitrary accountant's view of, let's say, he's taking a figure of 18, 19 murders and he's looking at it as a profit and loss, I don't think you can quantify it in those terms.
Canova also said that the Fru were not rogue, and of course they were an official part of the British Army, but he did say they were practicing, they were working off the books, that he did imply that they were dark arts.
Okay, he is saying they're operating off books. Well, we're reporting to ministers, we're reporting to head of special branch, we're reporting to the security services, and ultimately our controlling direction. Let me just explain to you, Kieran. We can't recruit any agents without the permission of the head of special branch. HSB is absolutely fundamentally in control of everything we do. Every intelligence which comes in and gets exploited doesn't get exploited by the FRU. It gets exploited by TCG, 14 Company, 22 SES. Now, both of those two force units come under the direct control, not of the GOC Northern Ireland, but of the head of special branch. He is, this is Mr. Boucher. He is, in my opinion, being economical with the truth. They're not rogue, and we can evidence we're not rogue, because the legislators deliberately set up the law to allow what you might call dark events. But as individual intelligence operators, we were absolutely assured there was a lawful basis for operating.
You have alleged, now, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, but you have alleged that Scapaticci was used to, for want of a better term, to take out non-informing IRA men. Now, I don't know which is worse, because, I mean, if Scapaticci's taking out his fellow informers, that would seem to me, in a naive sense, to be very, very bad. But from the British Army's point of view, I mean, we can see the logic if Scapaticci's used to take out non-informing IRA men, that would be okay, a positive result, but it wouldn't be legal.
Okay. Well, none of it's legal because we didn't have a legal... that was my point right at the outset of this. And Mr. Boucher doesn't deal with this. What was the legal basis for the operation? There is none.
Okay.
We didn't have a legal basis. So by me asking you, Kieran, to join a proscribed organization, I am guilty of conspiring with you in an unlawful act. There is no protection. So we were guided by one rule and one rule only, which was the yellow card. That was the only lawful instruction that we had. This is why it's important that when you spend £40 million, I expect, indeed I demand, that Mr. Boucher actually gets down into the minutiae and deal with the actual basis of operation and who knew what, where, when and how.
But then, I mean, if you are operating without a legal basis, but you are operating as an official British Army unit under orders, then perhaps we're in the territory of semantics here. But I mean, were the FRU hung out to dry then, carrying out orders without legal basis?
Well, it's the same for the IUC at that time. They didn't have a legal basis for conspiring with any person who committed a criminal offence. But the whole essence is it suited legislators not to draw up strict guidelines. There was no, you know, rules. That wouldn't be a normal standard operating practice. You would expect a legislator's parliament would have ensured what your legal basis of operating was. We were assured that there was a legal basis. So the Army's legal department gave us assurances that you have a legal basis for operating. Now, nobody's ever been able to show me that. And if Mr. Boucher has it, I know for a fact, because I've got Canova on video and they're on record as saying that they've trawled through all the documentary evidence and there is none which shows any of the coursework which essentially identified the legal basis for operating. So in other words, what the covenant was.
Ian, I'm going to be slated for speaking to you today. That's the truth. Nevertheless,
Just explain to me, you know, why would you be slated for somebody that has consistently been accurate from day one? You know, we can lay this out in a timeline if you want. You know, when Republicans first said, well, you know, State Knife is not a one person, it's a conglomerate of maybe six or seven other agents. And then you've got the famous Barney Rowan and Anne Cadwallader interview and Mr. McGuinness and Mr. Adams personally vouching for Scapaticci when they knew full well that they'd previous investigations by the Republican movement into him. And just coincidentally, that those investigations were actually used in evidence against me in the initial affidavit sworn. And, you know, there are, just to give one example, there were people within the Republican movement who absolutely were convinced that Mr. Scappaticci was an agent. Padraic Wilson is one. And he was one of the people who re-interviewed him when he comes back from Dundalk when he was on the run in late 91-92. So for Mr. McGuinness and Mr. Adams, and Mr. McGuinness was his day-to-day superior who controlled the internal security unit on GHQ, for you to say that you're going to get slated for right. speaking to somebody who essentially has been in the public interest trying to be objective and fair to all sides, because my job is for society. I didn't join the FRU to attack Republicans. I didn't join the FRU. My first job was to infiltrate loyalists in that sense.
Well, I can say, look,
I've been objective all the way through here.
You were right about Scappaticci. I mean, I don't think anybody's yeah. any doubt about that. You are a unique source in that you worked with you know, the FRU and military intelligence here. But that's why I'm going to be slated, is because you've also alleged that Martin McGuinness protected Scappaticci. Martin McGuinness denied it, Sinn Féin denied it, Martin McGuinness's family, of course, denied it, and no evidence has ever come out about that.
Okay. So Martin McGuinness also denied that he was the last person to see Frank Hegarty, one of my agents, alive. Martin McGuinness was also, if you look at the Coote report, the man that essentially ran Scappaticci, or was responsible within the internal security unit, was Mr. McGuinness. Now, ultimately, I'm in a very privileged position, and I really mean this in the true sense. So let me just explain to you. Frank Hegarty would have been a previously exposed agent within the Stickies in Derry, and he was persona non grata. I was a very, very junior person within the organisation. I was a collator. And we used the Frank Hegartys of this world as a test bed to be able to ingratiate the young bloods coming through to learn your skills in interviewing, debriefing agents. And I was a co-handler on the very early cases with Frank Hegarty. And the day that me and another guy called Frank, who was the handler, were brought into John Tobias's office and asked to have a meet with him and to ask him or direct him to get alongside Martin McGuinness. It was an unbelievable day because it was incredulous to us. So if you read Richie O'Rourke's book, it's very clear that the belief of Derry Pyra, leading members within Derry Pyra, is that this guy, Frank Hegarty, shouldn't be let anywhere near the RA. And the only person who sponsored Frank Hegarty throughout, and again, it's made clear by the head of what was the quartermaster in Derry in the book, that the sponsor was none other than Mr. McGuinness. And we, as the handlers, right at the start, couldn't believe this direction we were getting from John Tobias. But it was incredulous, but the path was a relatively smooth one from being a compromised agent, already compromised, to being essentially second in command of strategic weapons, Libyan weapons, which were under his control. Now, for political reasons, the decision was taken to essentially compromise it and cement, which was the Anglo-Irish agreement with Garrett Fitzgerald. So he was compromised. So we were able to get him out to a secure location. I mean, unfortunately, events after that resulted in a lot of pressure being applied to Mr. McGuinness, who felt the need to lure back Frank. And as the family, both Dorothy and his mother, made clear, Mr. McGuinness was the person who sponsored and said, you know, I will guarantee you a safe return. And sadly, that wasn't true. Now, in the normal course of any murder investigation, the last person who has contact with the deceased is prime person to be in the frame. And the police were stopped from investigating that.
Martin McGuinness, of course, He is deceased. He would have denied this, but
of course he would.
I leave that up to the listener, Ian.
Absolutely. I mean, you only have to look at the video of him, which has him behind the vehicle with a bomb, a weapon, and it subsequently exploding, and the VRN being established as being the vehicle. And in London, New York, the American broadcaster was asked not to process that film. And that stood for many, many years until a fantastic journalist, Darren McIntyre, actually managed to transmit that.
This is rare footage of IRA members assembling a car bomb in Derry. It is unique, not just because very few people have ever seen it, but because of who features in it. One of the IRA's emerging leaders has a starring role.
A very dangerous alarm clock timer. I could blow them all to hell.
Who do you recognize?
It's Mark McGuinness. Handling weapons, a rifle and a revolver. Rolling up to a load of kids who are staring in the windows and craning in the windows, and he's showing them bullets. It's horrific, really.
And again, I have to be careful here because, you know, there are still people who are in sensitive positions, but I am absolutely 100% convinced that Mr. McGuinness was certainly not for the FRU and certainly not for the RUC, but he was an agent of influence.
What was the motivations of the people recruited as agents? Was it personal, was it political, or was it profit?
Well, initially, in most cases, it was ideological.
In what sense?
In the sense that they were revolted about violence. I'll give you one classic example. Another one of Mr. McGuinness's brainwaves was the human bomb. And what logic would it lead anybody to believe that society would accept strapping a bomb to a Kurtec and driving into a PVCP would do anything other than the revulsion of society, which is what happened. And people, I wouldn't say flocked to pass information, but once you've got an acorn, it grows. And there are incidents, you know, like the Enniskillen bomb was another case. Solyanon bomb was another case. And it would have been the same with Omagh, although, you know, I'm guessing here. But any of the atrocities would be an absolute goldmine.
So, I mean, ideology in terms of like frustration or disgust or a fallout with the IRA, it wouldn't as if someone got up in the morning and decided that, you know, they'd lived their life wrongly and they were now loyal to the Crown.
So you know full well the level of penetration within Newry. Newry Pyru was well known to be absolutely riddled with informers. Derry City was the same. But if you went a few miles down the road down to South Armagh, you know, the level of penetration was almost zero. And Tyrone, almost zero. The difference being the family units, the loyalty, which was shown and exhibited between families. So that was difficult to penetrate. But in big, you know, like Newry, Derry, Belfast, it was relatively easier. But not easy.
How much of the IRA did you and the FRU and other intelligence groupings manage to turn, do you think? I mean, okay. I know it's guesswork.
Okay, well, no, it's a fair point. It's a fair point. And what I would say, to put into context, so Sir John Stevens gave evidence to Parliament, and he was asked this very question. And he said out of 214 people that he were arrested in Stevens 1, 2 and 3, he gave a figure of people who were, and I'm going to stress this word, who were not agents. 4. So out of 214 people that he arrested, only 4 were not agents of one or other or multiple agencies. Because you've got to remember this, sometimes forces recruited not only by the FRU, but by the RUC, the ID, and customs, because customs also ran intelligence operations. So loyalism is on a different scale to the Republican community. So in regards to the IRA, I certainly wouldn't put it on the level of loyalism. But I would think in the senior level, so the officer level, I would think one in three. And at the foot soldier level, the volunteer level, maybe one in four.
Still, with that level of penetration, it's difficult to see how this organization functioned at all.
Well, it didn't, and to a certain extent. So if you look at, say, some of the offences which took in place in the United Kingdom on the mainland, you know, some of the mainland bombings, those operations, they weren't run from Belfast. They were run from South Armagh and safe locations and parts of the Republic. So that penetration is completely different. But within the 32 counties, and Garda Síochána Conor had a very, very, very good coverage. The IUC had by far better coverage than we did generally, but not at the upper scale. And we benefited from internment and the early days. And then towards the end of the trouble, so certainly in the mid to late 80s, the early 90s, we were strangled as a unit by the RUC and essentially didn't want us to operate in an effective way. And they could do that because, as I explained to you, we couldn't recruit. We couldn't put people on the books without our HSB and the head of special branch authorising that recruitment.
Certainly is a fascinating conversation. There's a lot to take in. You've clearly led a very interesting life and a very interesting career. So, I thank you for your time. There are things that people would dispute, but that's the nature of this. This is the nature of the whole intelligence things, and even people writing about it and people arguing over it and former members of the IRA and fallouts and everything else. So,
Kieran, absolutely. You've summed that up perfectly. But what happened last week, we had Cheltenham and we had Cheltenham races. Now, each and every one of those races, the punters that go before they put their money on the horse, the first thing they do is look at the form. So they look at the past history. And if you look at my form, it's been pretty damn consistent. And if you look at others' form, it's been inconsistent. And if you look at Mr. Boucher, for example, £40 million investigating up Canova. And I've got to be honest, a kiddie could do better. And that's the sad indictment of where we are. And the people that really have lost here, the victims and the victims' families, they've been treated in a cruel way for me.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.